Welcome to Bridgehead, the podcast brought to you by The Bridge here at Wellington College, where we'll be joined by a series of interesting guests to explore some of the most topical issues in the education sector.
So I'm so happy that you're here today and Wellington. I've been looking forward to this day and to share with other people a conversation with you, Liam Isaac, about Lego serious play, but also about all kinds of other things that have to do with productive ways to engage with one another and with students. So yeah, tell us about Lego serious play.
Of course, yeah, great. Well, thanks for having me, first of all. So Lego serious play, at its heart, it's a method that helps people to enhance the way in which they communicate with others, and it helps in a learning context to make thinking visible. So you might want to think about using Lego bricks a little bit like a 3D printer for your brain. So you quite literally build a representation of what's going on in your head. One of the ways you do that is, if you think about the conventional way you build with Lego, you try and build literal models. When you're using Lego serious play, you use the bricks as metaphors for ideas. So you can take any brick and say it represents anything at all. And if you put that in your model and say, you know, this red brick represents my well-being, that is what it represents in the model. And in that way, you're able to use the bricks to quite quickly build complex representations of your thinking. And you can explore the way in which those different concepts that you're trying to articulate to others are connected. So you get to kind of very physically build out the kind of metaphorical connections between the concepts in your head. And that can help you to tell really compelling stories about what you think, how you feel, depending on the application.
So when you say making thinking visible, I'm of course thinking about visible thinking. Mm-hmm. And so, is there an element here of serious play as a pedagogical method that is intending to develop or to support metacognitive awareness?
So that's an interesting question. I think the way that the original method was devised was definitely not with pedagogy and learning in mind. It was very much a corporate application to facilitate meetings. Much of my work is around, I don't know whether to term this as hacking the process or exploring the process for applications in education. That's kind of what I've been championing for the last few years. I think it can help metacognitively. I think it can help learners to better understand not just what they think, but why they think it. Because I think when you build your response as opposed to vocalize your response, a bit like we were talking about earlier, you give the opportunity for much more effective whole brain thinking. So if you ask someone to vocalize their thoughts on a particular topic, we know that the barrier of having to use language to do that can have a number of potential influences on their ability to effectively articulate their thinking. You've got the limitations of working memory. If you're introducing the need to pick the right words as well as identify what you want to say, then you're kind of dividing that working memory. So there's an increased cognitive load, which means there's a potential that the individual learner will struggle to articulate the full complexity of their thought. There's also, with language, the potential that, because in most people your kind of language processing is on the same side of the brain as a desire to oversimplify, to think reductively, there's the potential that the responses in purely vocal sense or written sense will be limited by the fact that your kind of language processing forces you to be more likely to go down that reductive mindset. When you ask people to build models, you take away the barriers, or at least you reduce some of the barriers of language, because someone can build a model of what they think without having to worry about how to articulate it. So I can build my response to show my thinking linked to a particular topic. And then once I built it, what LEGO Serious Play does is it decouples the kind of tangible model building from then what we call the kind of storytelling. So you build your thinking, focusing much more of your kind of working memory on articulating the complexity of your thought, and then you tell the story using that model as a framework over which to tell that story. So you kind of decouple the need to pick the right words and pick what you actually think at the same time.
Hmm.
I hope that makes sense.
It does. It's really interesting because, as you know, one of the things that fascinates me about the power, the potential of serious play is the way in which I believe it can empower communication to someone who is effectively experiencing some kind of constraint due to language. And so, yes, that this opening up of ways of sharing what is maybe difficult to articulate in words seems to me really, yes, as I said, really powerful and something that we could think about using in lots of different classroom environments. You were talking about telling stories, and I know that storytelling is central to some of your thinking about serious play. Can you tell us a bit about these different levels of play that you've spoken about in the past?
So I think within this method, there are levels and levels. I think we tend to, first of all, talk about build levels. When we talk about build levels, we're essentially talking about three different things. So at the most simple level, you can use Lego as an individual and you can build representations of your thinking using Lego bricks and then tell stories about them. And this helps you to, as I say, socialize your thinking and put your ideas out there in a way which is hopefully more tangible for others. So it helps people to learn from other people's experiences and thoughts because there is this concrete representation of those knowledge structures in front of you. The next level up in a Lego Serious Play sense is building at a shared level. And this is where you work collaboratively to build a single response to a particular stimulus. And what is nice about this, or that shared model build, is that you force learners in a social setting to not only hopefully build a final model which is representatively grander than the sum of its individual parts, because people are bringing different ideas and perspectives to that build. What it also does is forced groups to engage, narrowing over terminology, but those kind of essential skills. They have to work collaboratively to build a single response. They have to come to some kind of consensus. They have to think critically about what's important and what's not in the context of building that single shared model. So you have shared model building, and then above that you have this notion of building at a systems level, and this is where you are making systems thinking visible. So in a systems build, you're not only, let's say, building your shared representation of thinking around a certain subject, you're then also making explicit all the different agents and ideas that might influence the behavior of that system. And you build it and connect all those different system agents up, and then you can actually animate those models to see the ripple effects play out in real time. So you can actually not necessarily predict system behavior, because that's not necessarily possible, but you can certainly understand system behavior a little bit better if you're able to make it visible and actually identify where certain interventions will animate aspects of the system to see things like emergent behaviors.
When I first met you, it was at a conference in Toulouse, and I sat in on a session where we were, I was not familiar with any of the people in that school, but we were building a school. Mm. So what were the parts that were key to a school? So
yep.
A system within itself. And one of the things that I found really fascinating about the whole process is the socialization element. Mm. So I'm actually quite a timid person, and I'm not comfortable in groups, really, or not right away. And so to have something, I'm looking because now we have
Lego
pieces on the table, you know, that, you know, you gave us some question to think about, and then we could construct it, and you put your pieces. And so you, it gave you this sort of manipulating things with your hands seems to facilitate thinking in a lot of ways. And then the fact that afterwards we shared our bits with one another and we were explaining our thinking about things was something that in a way built a little mini community. And I'm wondering if you could talk a bit more about the socialization element of learning or exchange with Lego.
Yeah, sure. I mean, just to pick up on one thing you said just before that, you mentioned, you know, kind of wanting to get your hands on and build ideas. Have you heard of the homunculus man?
No.
So the homunculus man is kind of, it's a sculpture, and it's a representation of a human, but the size of the various parts of the body reflect the connections with the brain. And one of the biggest elements on the homunculus man is his hands. So one of the things we'll often say when we're talking about learning using Lego Serious Play is kind of think with your hands, which sounds a bit ridiculous. But actually, when you consider the level of connection between hands and brain, there's nothing to say, actually, that we're perhaps not better able to share our thinking with what we build and create with our hands than with what we say. And when you think about that from an evolutionary standpoint, we develop speech far later than we developed the ability to manipulate our environment physically. So that's kind of an aside. But I think an interesting one as to the value of using this as a means to communicate. We, you know, there is a chance that we might be better equipped to communicate with what we build than what we say. But going back to the socialization piece, there's a few key ideas linked to the method, I think, that make it an excellent tool for socializing learning. I think one, which we kind of touched on earlier, is linked to the way that we engage our brains when we're building models. So I referenced the left hemisphere of the brain earlier and the limitations of language. When we build, the reason it's so good for promoting whole brain thinking in the context of using Lego Serious Play is, whereas the left hemisphere is reductive and where the language is processed, the right hemisphere of our brain is, you know, it's not binary, but that's where typically we have our human-centered understanding of the world. It's where things like our emotions are more activated. It's also where we're able as people to recognize the complexity within which we and the things around us exist. So you might kind of term it a systems thinking side of the brain as opposed to a kind of reductive side of the brain. And I think the way that that side of the brain makes sense of the world is through metaphor and narrative. So in Lego Serious Play, we use bricks as metaphors and we build models to tell stories. Now, what that allows us to do when we engage in that whole brain thinking is we have a lot of what we know about the world stored in our brain as what you might term as tacit knowledge. We understand the world as a reflection of our experience within it. So the way I often challenge people to think about this is, if I ask someone to describe what love is, or if I ask someone, first of all, you know, do you know what love is? Most people will nod and say, well, of course I know what love is. But then you ask them to explain what love is, and it's often trips people up, because it's actually a very challenging thing to put into words, because it's not something you often are asked to do. But also the way that we understand love is through our experiences, not through reading an essay or answering a set of questions. So to actually articulate that can be really challenging. And what that means is, in a social learning context, it can be very difficult to learn from someone else's understanding of love if you are just asking them to share it in a traditional format. Can you write down what love is? Can you tell me what love is? Because it doesn't necessarily give them the means to connect to that experience, that kind of tacit experiential understanding of the concept. Whereas when you ask people to build, because they don't have that barrier of language, they are better able, at least in my humble experience and anecdotal experience, they're better able to build a representation of their thinking around that kind of tacit knowledge, and then devote time to sharing the story about it and make it concrete and explicit for everyone else. So in a social learning context, what we actually do when we build models about something and then share stories is we allow other people to see and better understand what is often hidden from our experiences as a concrete representation in model form.
So is it on some level a process through which something is revealed?
I think
maybe to oneself, maybe not, but perhaps to others?
I think it can be. I think it depends on the topic and the prompts. One thing I'll often hear, and this is a fairly common phrase if I'm walking around a workshop, I'll often hear people say something along the lines of, oh, I didn't realize I felt that way, or I'm not quite sure why I shared that. And I think that is testament to the fact that there are things that we know that we don't often articulate. And this is one mechanism for helping us articulate those things a little bit better. So whether it's, I guess it depends on the level of introspection that person engages in as to whether that is a reveal, or whether that is more of a, oh, this is, you know, perhaps clarity or shining a light on what they know but they didn't realize they knew. So I think there may be an element of that, yeah.
So I feel like it would be so easy to start slip into some purely philosophical discussion, and I'm going to try to rein myself in and move back this way. Maybe go back to the beginning of defining things in a way. Maybe there are people listening who are thinking, well, not only do I not know how to define love exactly, but I'm not sure I know how to define play.
Mm.
So what is it that we're actually talking about?
Yeah, and that's it's a great point. I think when we talk about play, or when I talk about play, there are a couple of defining ideas which I think are really important. The first is, when I talk about play, I tend to lean into the Lego Foundation's kind of definition of what makes playful learning, because in my work in education, I typically focus on playful learning. And what they say is play has five key principles or characteristics. So not necessarily all at the same time, but when we are learning through play, that process should be socially interactive, it should be meaningful, it should be actively engaging, it should be iterative, and it should be joyful. Those five principles, in my experience, they're very visible when you're using LEGO Serious Play as a tool, and I think they are the bedrock of what makes it a really effective tool for what I term kind of building better learning experiences. I think there's a second idea to lay on top of that, which is what's known as the continuum of play. And the continuum of play is a way to help people understand the extent to which what they are doing in a learning context can be determined playful or not. And in the continuum of play, excuse me, at the one end, you have this notion of free play. So at one end of the continuum, you have free play, which is to say, I, as an educator or facilitator, will create an environment, a playful environment, and I will then introduce a group of people to that environment and give them complete agency of choice over what they do. So the most obvious example, I guess, would be a playground. You put the things in the playground that you hope will create a playful experience. You open the doors, and then the students choose with complete sense of agency what they do, how they play. They choose the games, they choose the rules, they choose pretty much everything about how they want to engage with that environment. If you move along that continuum, the next level is what's called guided play. So this is where, as the educator, facilitator, you are, I guess, stripping away a little bit of the agency. So you are taking slightly more ownership of the process by adding constraints to that environment.
So you might set them a challenge that they need to achieve within a certain amount of time, and then say, okay, here's all the stuff you could use to do it, off you go. I mean, project-based learning might be a great example of guided play. You're kind of nudging them. They still have a lot of agency, but you're kind of closing the constraints, if you like, so that they have a little bit more direction. Next up in the spectrum, you have games, and this is where they're still playing, but the agency is even less on the learner, because there are rules, there's a clear outcome, you might put them into teams, so you are really dictating the path they're going to take through that playful experience. So you have this spectrum of play and these principles of play, and I think once you get your head around that, you can understand both what you are already doing, how that is playful or not on this spectrum of play, but also I think the value that learning through play can bring into any learning setting. Because I think one of the challenges I face in my work is a misunderstanding of what constitutes learning through play. I think that can be a barrier to the work that I do. And therefore, when I introduce purposeful play to a group, I tend to strip it back to those key ideas and challenge people to identify if that is the type of environment they would want for learning to take place in.
It's interesting because, you know, you spoke about the playground, and I think lots of people probably make an assumption when we talk about play that even learning through play is for young children,
mm-hmm.
and that we don't learn through play after a certain point in our lives, and yet, you know, what you're saying is that that's not true, that there's yeah. all kinds of environments in which the things that you put in place allow people to think creatively. I mean, at least in my mind, I make a real link between creative thinking and playful thinking.
Mm.
And that this is something that could be done with adults. It could be done in a group of teachers working on, I don't know, some element of the curriculum, or am I going off on a totally
no, not at all.
Different direction?
I think that, you know, as I've stepped away from the classroom in my role now, the majority of my work is with adult learners, whether that's in schools or beyond. So I think within schools, I've done lots of work with staff for professional development, whether that's around play or whether it's using play to explore other ideas like diversity, equity, and inclusion. You mentioned kind of futures thinking for what does the next generation of education look like. I've also worked with a kind of executive teams, kind of top level school leaders, to use play to co-create and challenge their strategic commitments. So we are talking about using play at every level, essentially. And my work outside of schools and education includes the same kind of what you might term as, I hate to say it, but high level thinking. This isn't a icebreaker activity. This isn't a method that's designed to be frivolous. This is incredibly purposeful work. And what people are getting out of it as outcomes are fundamentally better than what they would get if they weren't using play to explore these ideas. Because, I mean, just for one, touch on one of those principles earlier, the idea that play is socially interactive. One of the core principles of LEGO Serious Play is that everybody builds a model and everybody shares the story of their model. So you might compare that to a typical staff meeting or strategic development meeting where you might have lots of voices in the room, but perhaps not everyone's opinion is shared with equity. In LEGO Serious Play, you don't have that. Everyone has that same equitable opportunity to share what they think. And then instead of having, okay, we've all kind of talked about it, these are the three bullet points we're going to move on with, you then encourage that whole group to co-construct a single shared outcome. So they don't just have the opportunity to share their story, they then have the ability to collaborate and support the building of the final agreed upon outcome, which hopefully means that outcome has more meaning for everyone in the group.
So when you're talking about this, I'm thinking about the serious clay approach as being something that's fundamentally democratic. And that is offering the possibility of exploring new ideas. So it's liberating and bringing to this process of co-creation a kind of multiplicity of perspectives, which we know diversity in thinking makes things better and stronger.
One of the ideas that I was just picking up on from what you just said then was we were talking about a kind of collaborative environments and democracy. One of the things that I think is a really important idea linked to the use of Lego serious play is because you are building models to represent your thinking, what you're essentially doing is you are you're fundamentally changing the nature of the conversation. So as you and I are talking now, we're having a direct conversation. Now we haven't known each other quite well. So perhaps some of the anxieties and challenges and barriers that might normally influence the way that we approach that conversation aren't what they would be if we were meeting each other for the first time, or if there was a power dynamic at play, or if we had an awkward relationship. There are any number of things that can make a conversation challenging. One of the nice things about using models to have a conversation is that you introduce a third point. So as soon as I build my model to represent my thinking, and then you and I start talking about this model, the very nature of that conversation changes from direct, me to you, to indirect. So we now talk through this model. Now, once you start talking through a model, there are a couple of wonderful things that happen. The first is those ideas that were in my head, and perhaps I might have held very personally if I was describing them to you directly, they are now objectified and out there as a model, which is there's a certain amount of distance between me and the idea.
Mm-hmm.
So I call this decoupling. But when we see this phenomenon of decoupling, people become less personally sensitive to their model. Doesn't mean they're not at all invested, but there is a fundamental shift in the way that we view an objective model compared to what we say directly to someone else.
So say we're adding, you know, we don't know each other well, that somehow there's a tension or a difficulty, and we've put the problem or the question on the table. And now, if I'm giving feedback or if I'm offering some sort of critique of an idea or an action, you don't feel threatened.
Well, I think because you're not offering me directly criticism or feedback, you are offering feedback to the idea, the thinking that's now objectively separated from me. So if you were to say, oh, well, you know, this is an interesting story that you've built here, these ideas, what would happen if we can together rebuild and talk through that model as an idea that is separate to me personally? So one of the reasons in my work, I spend a lot of time working with teams, focusing on facilitating challenging conversations. It's because this phenomenon of decoupling makes those challenging conversations easier. First of all, because you're objectifying the ideas. But second of all, there is that distance creates this psychological safe space around the idea.
Can you talk about this in relation to the parent-teacher conversation? Because I think that's a really interesting
space. So this is one of the applications that I've been developing kind of on and off for a while. And it's the notion that when you think of a classic parent-teacher conference, there's an awful lot of, I'm just going to call it noise, happening around that. You have parent-child dynamics. You have teacher-staff dynamics. You have teacher-student dynamics. There's an awful lot there that can make that a really difficult conversation to have. Add into that, you might have English as second language learners. You might have English as second language parents in a British school context. There's so much that can make that tough. Now, one of the potential applications of LEGO Serious Play, which makes that process hopefully easier, is that you can share your thinking. Let's talk about like academic progress. Let's say we're building models about progress in a subject. What you're able to do is, in advance of a parent-teacher conference meeting, a student can build their model to show how they think they are doing. You know, it could be the classic, you know, where do you think your strengths lie? Where do you think there's an area for development? What's stopping you from doing whatever it is that the aspirational goal is in that subject? So the student can build their model, share that story with the teacher. The teacher, and this might happen before the parent-teacher conference, we often have pre-meetings these days before you have PTCs. So the teacher can then hear that story and share their in-person feedback about the model. I agree with those strengths. That's an interesting area for development. I think there might be this, this, or this. And you can, in real time, rebuild that. That student can then take that model home to the parent. They can introduce that model to the parent in advance of the meeting. And then you can have that same conversation, the same nature of conversation. Okay, so, you know, as my from my parent perspective, this is what I think. Let's rebuild it. But significantly, this is all built on the student's initial grounding. So it's the student who has ownership of this model, because, you know, PTCs are often, I think, they're probably worded wrong. Parent-teacher, you know, perhaps it should be child-parent-teacher, because actually we sometimes I think we forget who it's for. And this model helps to ground it in being student-focused, because they're the ones who are connecting the dots here. And then when you have the meeting of minds, you have this model which everyone has seen, everyone has heard the story of, we might have seen some revisions, and then you can talk through the model. Because what that does is it makes the focus on initially what the student feels, but then you have these different perspectives that have challenged, hopefully in a really positive way, how the student feels about their kind of academic progress within the subject. And then any revisions can be made either in real time in that parent-teacher conference, or perhaps even more powerful is to give the student again agency to take it away and say, okay, so now we've had our parent-teacher conference, why don't you rebuild that model, take a snapshot, annotate over the top of it, and use it to inform what next. So I think in that way, you give everyone, I mean, I remember one of the phrases when I was doing PTCs was no surprises, right? It was, you don't want to have to turn up and have to say something or hear something that you weren't expecting. In this way, I think you help support this idea that there shouldn't be any surprise about what you hear, because this model is a tangible representation of the same story and it bounces from place to place. So it makes it, it very physically connects the dots between the conversations that are happening at home and at school. And then ultimately, like I said, again, it gives the student the ability to make sure they are taking the important decisions on one side of things, but also the important takeaways. Because ultimately, if it's not about them, what's the point? In my humble opinion.
No, I'm with you. I'm with you on that. And I'm thinking, as you mentioned progress at one point, and I'm thinking back to an earlier conversation, but also one of those principles of play is being iterative.
Mm.
And so, you know, one of the things we know about the way the human brain works, the way we really assimilate knowledge, is through repetition. Mm-hmm. And sometimes through when we are exposed to or encounter content, knowledge in different forms. So we were talking about this earlier, and I really love the idea and love to hear you talk about it now, about how you could have a child build, a student, an adult, any learner, build a model on what they think they know prior to entering into a topic, and then progressively.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this is linked to, there are many different applications and kind of strategies. One of the ones that I've had real success with is what I call kind of bookends or bookending. So this is essentially where you're having a unit, and I have a quite strong concept-based teaching and learning background. So we often have, in concept-based teaching and learning, big questions, right? So they are the overarching questions through which the rest of the content is structured and delivered. So one of the things I really like to do in a concept-based context is ask the students to build a model to represent their response to that big question at the beginning of a unit. So they build what they know. And this is almost like the kind of testing for prior knowledge, right? So they build, and I think of that as a physical representation of their existing knowledge structures, their schema, if you like, what they are, what they know about this topic. What you can then do is, as you're working your way through a unit, is you can repeat this question. So if they keep that model and take it away or take a picture so they can rebuild it later, 4 weeks into the unit, you might ask them once again, okay, home learning task tonight. We've taken a look at these case studies. We've done X, Y, and Z. Same question. Build a model to show me what you know about, you know, the big question for that topic. And they build their model. They might build the initial model and then change it. They might build the model and add to it. And all the while, they're kind of rethinking what they know and representing that in model form throughout the unit. They can then do the same thing again at the end of the unit. So if they have an 8-week unit, they build again at the end. What do I know now? And then what's lovely is then they can put those things together. If they've taken images and they've captured those model stories, they can put those model stories together, those kind of annotated images or whatever it is. And they can not only know what they know, they can also celebrate the progress of what they've learned. So this is what I've learned. But also if they've done this well, they can also identify where other people's thinking has challenged what they know. Because there are things we're good at in education, there are things we are not so good at. We're good at outcome, generally. Whether what we do with it is good or not is a different question. But we're good at summatively saying where someone's at. What we're not always good at is allowing each individual to see the progress that they've made and focused on their own individual learning. And we used the example earlier of what if a kid gets an F at the end of a unit? I'm not sure of your assessment processes, but let's just say you have an end of unit test, classic British kind of summative assessment. If a student gets an F, then if that's their key takeaway from a unit, there's very little arguably positive that student can take from that unit. Versus if a student gets an F, but they have a visual representation of what they have learned and the progress they have made, that F becomes superfluous compared to look what you knew originally, look what you know now. You might need some exam prep, but you can show them where they have developed their thinking. So if you're able to use it in this way,
you give people help.
But also you celebrate the process. And I think if we're going to promote this kind of very cliche phrase of lifelong learners, we have to give every learner the opportunity to celebrate what they learn and celebrate the process of learning. And I think we have to take a look at ourselves as educators and say, are we giving people that opportunities? If we are, great. If we're not, we need to think about how we can introduce structures into our programs of study to allow them to do that.
So it can be seen.
So you can see it. And what's important is you can map it against each other. Because there's something, I think it's the third time I've used this today, but the visceral about being able to see a tangible change in representation of your thinking. Because we as human beings, we're not very good in abstraction. We don't deal with abstraction very well. What we're very good at is what we can see and what we know is real. So if we can see a representation of the evolution of our thinking and how it's changed, it becomes much more powerful and meaningful for us. And we can cling to that as something that's, yeah, okay, I can put these things together and I can tangibly understand the value of this process and how it's changed and shaped my thinking.
So we started with visible thinking and we've come back to visible thinking. So maybe we should stop there for today. But I certainly hope it won't be the last conversation and I, we can drum up all kinds of exciting projects in the future.
Great. Well, thank you very much for letting me speak. It's been really enjoyable.
Thank you.
Please leave a comment, ask a question, and like, follow, and subscribe to hear more from Bridge Ed. You can also follow The Bridge on LinkedIn, and you can find out more information on our website at thebridge.wellingtoncollege.org.uk. Until next time.